brought to you by the Computer History Museum.
You're listening to CHM Live Radio. I'm Lauren Miyamoto, and I produce the museum's live speaker series. Each year, we bring incredible guests to the museum to talk about computing and the transformational effect it's having on our society. We've hosted a wide range of speakers, from geneticists and asteroid miners to technology giants like Elon Musk and Sheryl Sandberg. Today's episode features Mary Lou Jepsen. She's led Facebook's virtual reality efforts, advised Google's Sergey Brin, and invented $100 laptops. Now she's turning her consumer electronics experience to the task of curing disease affordably.
The reason healthcare has gotten more expensive is because we have better technology, and the technology has made it more expensive. And so as technologists working on healthcare, I think it's part of our job to try to massively lower the cost.
Mary Lou is working on a medical imaging device that you could wear on your head like a beanie or wrap around your arm like a bandage. This device is low cost, portable, and highly effective. So how does a wearable MRI work? What could this mean for patients and doctors? Why did Mary Lou leave her Silicon Valley career to focus on neuroscience? Find out in this conversation between Mary Lou Jepsen and former museum CEO John Holler. It was recorded in May 2017.
Holography. Talk about what inspired you to think about that as a pursuit and how you created this holographic system so early in your career.
When I started college, I made a deal with my parents. I wanted to be an English major, and they said, you can go to the local school if you want to be an English major. And I agreed to major in electrical engineering as long as they'd help me pay for college. So I had to be a double E major. And you only get one elective, and there was this elective in holography. And I thought, wow, that would be really cool. So I took this holography course. I didn't like the electrical engineering at all. I mean, I kind of hated it. But I fell in love. It was the closest thing to a religious experience I ever had, the magic of making it and this thing coming out that was a hologram that was 3D and like, wow, I made that. But what did I do? How does that work? And I wanted to understand deeply the electromagnetics of it, the optics of it, the physics of it, the chemistry of it, the human visual system, and the computer graphics and all the stuff that I took deep dives in after.
Before you built that, was this class, this one elective on holography, just theoretical? Were you just talking about the theory of holography?
Oh, I made the world's first holographic video system. Holography won the Nobel Prize in, 1971, Nobel Prize in Physics. So the first people that made, really, the first holograms were in the 60s. So I was taking a class on how to make a hologram and got really hooked on it and really wanted to understand a lot about it. So the thing that I did as a grad student at the Media Lab, maybe my first really big innovation in holography was the first, with a team of graduate students, it was a team effort for sure, we made the world's first fully computer-generated holographic video system where we simulated the physics of the holography process in the computer and made a display where the pixels were approximately the size of the wavelength of light. So like today for HDTV, that's 2,000 by 1,000 pixels. We had 25,000 pixels per inch in this thing. And I made that screen by hand so that I could show the wave nature of light in the screen so we could make the hologram work.
And imaging has been such a passion of yours for so long. What is it about all the things that you could have pursued in math and science and technology? Why imaging? Why was that the thing that held such fascination?
70% of our minds are allocated to processing visual information. It's how we think about the world. I loved math and art growing up. It combined them in an interesting way. I mean, for me, it's really interesting to do, as a kid, a really technically hard problem, math, and then find the solution as a visual reward. And I think also, I was interested in art and science, and a lot of people think that you can't do both. But you can, and in fact, each informs the other. And I think, actually, if more scientists and technologists did more art, we'd have a lot more creativity, STEAM, not STEM. where the science, technology, engineering, and math is the STEM acronym. If you add in art, we could get a lot more, a lot faster, a lot more innovation.
Okay, I want to jump now into your current idea,
right?
Which is, I read somewhere it was described sort of as a mashup of MRI and telepathy, and it's a really big idea, and I want to sort of unpack it for everyone so that they can really understand what the central idea is and then how you're carrying it out. So can you just get started and then we'll have a conversation about it?
We have these big dreams. I was trying to figure out how to do telepathy since I was a kid, and who knew? It's funny, as I was remarking on talking, I had no idea that I'd end up here talking to you about a telepathic system, at this age. But yeah, I figured out how to do it, mostly because I wanted to figure out how to do it. I became really fascinated with how the mind worked because, for a personal reason, I had non-elective brain surgery. I was going to die unless I had brain surgery. I had a brain tumor removed in my 20s. And that, neuroscience became a side project as a means of self-preservation subsequently, and I learned a lot about it. And I kept thinking, looking at the systems that we have, how can I figure out a way to, first I was thinking of radiating brain tumors and communicating with thought. Like, I've just been noodling on the problem for decades, wondering how to do it. And the truth is, there is a system that's been available for 10 years now that does do this, that enables us to communicate with thought, to be able to at least read your thoughts. If I threw any one of you right now in an MRI machine, hi Fred, I could tell you what images you were thinking of, what words you're about to say, whether you're paying attention or not, whether you're in love or not, and on and on and on. We can do that today with a multi-million dollar MRI scanner. And so when I saw that about 5-6 years ago, I thought, wow, we just have to figure out how to up the resolution and lower this down. Maybe I can use some of my consumer electronics know-how to help this happen because it seems so fundamental. I nearly died because an MRI of my brain was too expensive, and I suffered for many years. Many people suffer from that. So I was interested in both telepathy, enabling the moonshot being communicating with thought alone. I think in images. I would love to be able to just dump my images directly to the computer. Why do I like displays? I think in images.
And the images you're thinking about.
I don't think in language. Yeah. I don't, yeah. As people do, but I don't. I think very visually. And it would be great. And I know musicians who think, in layers of sound. And it's so hard to get the layers of sound out of their head. Can we do this? It sounds nuts. But I'm comfortable with people thinking I'm working on something impossible or I'm stark raving. And, as a woman in technology, like, two things are true. I'm underestimated, but I'm remembered because I look different. And so I learned that if I say crazy stuff, people remember that. And then when I do the crazy stuff, they're like, whoa, I thought she was nuts. She got that done. And then they bet on you the next time. The thing is, how do you do it? And so, a few years ago, about 5 years ago, I saw this system from Washington University in St. Louis, and they were using optics to match the resolution of functional magnetic resonance imaging, using the principle that your body is basically, it's opaque to visible light, that's what we can see. But if you shine near infrared light on it, and you've put on night vision goggles to let you see near infrared light, you will all look ghost-like. They'll look like milk or lemonade, somewhere in between, and you'd scatter the light. And so using time of flight imaging, they were able to match the resolution of fMRI to 1 inch or 1.5 inches down into the skull and be able to pull words and images out of people's heads.
We think of these big machines that you lay inside of, and every MRI, as you said, you almost died because you couldn't afford to have an MRI, and
right.
It's thousands and thousands of dollars to do this. It seems so distant and unreachable as a technology for us to think about wearing and having it be personal and then be the basis of this.
It's a big, huge magnet,
it
right?
Is.
It's a big, huge magnet, and it's getting 10% better every 7 years. They cost millions of dollars. If you look at their profit centers for the hospital, the $50 billion of revenue per year in the U.S. alone for MRI scans, 30 million scans per year. It's a cash cow. So like, it's really expensive, and yet like we don't even use it for diagnosing most diseases. We know MRI is a better diagnostic from breast cancer, and we don't use it, not just in the U.S., but in any country in the world. And so for years, I tried to sort of thought, maybe it's not bigger magnets, maybe it's better magnets. And I worked with these things called squids. And then I saw this paper from WashU, and I thought, wow. And it was this big fiber optic wig with these like refrigerator size amplifiers and decoders of the signal. And they were only getting an inch down, but I thought, wow. This is amazing. This is optics. That's what my PhD is in. This is my thing. Like, maybe I could help. These guys are pretty good, but they're not really consumer electronics experts. If you looked at the system, you're like, it's clear. Like, they're not. I've visited them, and I've become friends with them. They're really not. Like, they haven't shipped billions of dollars worth of product in the carriage of physics. So I thought, maybe I could figure something out that could make that system a lot better. And it turns out that I have, and we don't need to do the time of flight stuff, we don't need the refrigerators, we can fit it into a ski hat or a bandage, something at higher resolution than MRI that enables us to communicate with thought, detect tumors, see if you've got internal bleeding, see if you have a clogged artery, see if your tumor is shrinking or growing, monitor your body. Like the same way you can buy a blood pressure cuff at the drugstore, why can't you buy a system that can monitor your body and tell you what's going on, how the changes are.
So quite apart from the telepathic part of this, this is going to have, if you're successful, this is going to have enormous medical benefits just as a device to do what MRI does today.
Right. The number one healthcare expenditure in the world is brain disease. The billion people that are completely disabled and cannot work because they have either debilitating mental disease or neurodegenerative disease. The therapies haven't changed for them in 30 years, but a portable system that can neurologically monitor and allow directed therapy. So this system can read and write, deliver light to certain parts to reactivate or with drugs signal different things, or just to monitor neurological activity to see if you've got a blood clot, to see if an epileptic seizure is coming on. And on, there's a ton of possibilities that massively lower the cost of healthcare.
Anyone who's had an MRI or has seen the image would know it's a pretty fantastic image, and at high resolution, it really is very amazing. What is the image that your very small technology, very inexpensive technology, produces?
Right now, we're at 100 times the resolution and the center of your brain at 4 inches, using essentially LCDs and detectors that are made in the factories that make your smartphone, using the trillion-dollar manufacturing supply chain of Asia. So rather than a multi-million dollar system, you could buy something with higher resolution than MRI for less than the cost of your smartphone, which means an MRI scan for less than the cost of a phone call. So that's can be transformative to healthcare. I met a guy from Tencent, the Chinese company, who said they did this whole study in the developing world in clinics throughout Africa, Latin America. The US has also developing world clinics. And went around, did a survey, asked the people running the hospitals if you could wave a magic wand and you could get one piece of equipment, what would that piece of equipment do and how would it change the healthcare you're able to deliver? And the number one thing on that list was a portable MRI. It was shocking to me. I didn't know that until Tencent told me that. But it could be quite transformed because they don't have electricity. These things cost $1 million a year to maintain, and you need helium, and just the whole outfit of it is. It's amazing. It was such a breakthrough when it came out.
So it's,
I'm here because of MRI.
Yeah.
It's too expensive. The reason healthcare has gotten more expensive is because we have better technology, and the technology has made it more expensive. And so as technologists working on healthcare, I think it's part of our job to try to massively lower the cost, like we did in the $100 laptop.
Yeah. I actually think it would be good if you can explain it in easily understandable terms, because it's such amazing technology, and it's fitting right on your head. It's
right.
It's inside a hat band, essentially, the way you've described it. And I think it would be interesting to actually describe how that imaging works of the human brain.
So how does this work? It's a whole different rethink of it. It uses basically a principle that's been known, if you go back to the beginning, back to the first holograms, to the first holographer, figured this out, that you can make a hologram through a scattering medium. And in this case, that's your body. You can make a hologram of a scattering medium and invert it. And by inverting it, if we think holography uses the wave nature of light, and light's a wave, as we discussed, if I drop a rock in the middle of a pool and the ripples radiate outwards, that's also, you can think of that, visualize that as an optical wave, even though it's a pool wave. If I took some transducers on the side of the pool and shook them at just the right way, I could make the ripple pattern go in reverse. That's what phase conjugation is. And now you're all experts on the math. I think of math really visually. I spare you the equations. But that's what we do. That's a 1D, if you will, or 2D field. That's what we do in 3D. If I dropped a million rocks in the pool, we could reconstruct that ripple pattern. And that's what holography does, is it records these ripple patterns of the wavelength of light. Like the wavelength of the ripples, that's the peak to peak. Like you've got these peaks and troughs in waves and in ripples. You also have that in light. It's just a lot smaller. It's a hundredth of the width of a hair, that wavelength. But you record that and invert that, which is sort of like, this is a techie audience, so I can say, like, you know, if it's 7/8 pi that hits the pixel, you compute 9/8 pi. It's a really simple computation. You can do it in the screen itself. And so what you can do is then basically make your body effectively transparent to the light. So to the light, through the hologram, your body becomes transparent. And you can look, the scattering goes away. And you can look at the blood flow. You can look at the tumors. You can look at the different other features then in high resolution using literally an LCD that was made in the factory that makes the screen in your cell phone, which costs about $30. Ours will be more expensive first because they're custom, and you know, it's a couple million dollars for the mask set, and you know, but like really, it's completely doable, and we can image the whole body that way. And using that and the principles of functional magnetic resonance imaging and looking at oxygen flow, we can image the words you're about, the words you're going to say, the images in your head, the thoughts in your head. And so the reason I'm talking about this so publicly is like, this is really, we have to define what it means to be responsible in unfolding this. And I can't separate the telepathy part from the medical part.
Yeah.
I could, I would, but I can't. It's the same technology.
That's what I think is so fascinating about this, because you see it as one continuous process. It's
right.
The telepathy occurs as the result of this science that you're doing, the science of imaging on
right.
the brain. Now, so let's talk about that for a minute. How is it that the imaging tells us what you're about to say, the colors that you're seeing, the words you're thinking, the music in your head? How does all that work through the imaging process?
We were talking backstage about a professor at UC Berkeley, Jack Gallant, who ran a study in his lab, and they threw three graduate students in MRI machines for hundreds of hours, and made them watch YouTube videos.
I hope they got a great stipend or something.
I don't know how much they got paid. Right now they're doing it with Moth, the Moth storytelling series
yes.
from, I think, NPR. But this was YouTube videos, and they made fMRI recordings of the grad student's brain reacting to YouTube videos. So they had a library of reactions for each student and created a visual dictionary, using big data analytics, AI, and brain scan data.
And what does the brain look like when it's reacting?
Well, they just looked at what fMRI measures is oxygen use. What part of your brain in 10 cubic millimeter voxels is using oxygen. And based on that and pattern matching, it could predict when a new image sequence was shown what the student was watching, even though the computer didn't get to see the new video, just using the data store. It was a low resolution grainy image of Steve Martin walking across stage and the plane landing and on, but it was close. And I saw that and I'm like, whoa, we just need to up the resolution and lower the cost to be able to do this for real. It could change everything. It could change everything. Like, it's fun understanding how our mind works is fundamental. It's who we are. It's we're human. And like understanding the brain and being able to communicate at a higher baud rate. I mean, we're all kind of Stephen Hawking in the low bandwidth out of our brain, in that we can just move our mouths for talking or type with our fingers or draw or write. But there's a lot more going on in your head that we could dump out. We could, human creativity could be explosive, right? It's just speed will, everything now will seem slow. It's sort of like it used to be 100 years ago. It took 3 weeks to cross the Atlantic Ocean. Now we can do so in, well, if the Concorde was still around, 3 hours. But, you know, we can go around the world super fast. And we think of everything as going so fast. But I think in a decade when we have this at scale, we'll look back and we can just think something and it can appear. You can skip the whole, like, getting the image out of your head and the idea out of your head. I can make my devices work. We leverage the robots, the 3D printers, and all these things that are going to take our job. But we're more creative. We still have 100 billion neurons, each with 100,000 different connections. We're by far the most complex computer ever made that we have any idea how to make. And we're really good, I think, because the synapses are a bit unpredictable. Yeah. And so we can create.
Well, there's a creativity aspect and there's a privacy aspect, which I want to get to in a second. And then there's just the question of, do we want to know everything that's coming out of everyone's brain all the time, which is kind of another aspect to this. And we should think about that for a minute. But before we do that, I want to ask you about the computational power that is required for this. And whether what you're talking about is kind of achieving the dream science fiction has been talking about for decades, which is reverse engineering the brain and really understanding how the brain works and being able to, if not replicate it, at least just broadcast it. Is that right. Is that what we're talking about?
I think that's what we're talking about. There's a lot of good work being done in the neuroscience community. And to quote Paul Allen, co-founder of Microsoft, there's 5 Nobel Prizes just to understand how a neuron works. So you could say, how are you going to do telepathy? Because we don't even understand how a neuron works. And it's like, you know, you can still send an email and not understand how a transistor works. Maybe that's not a good analogy. But like, the point is, measuring oxygen flow alone, we can do this. We're hitting neurons. We can measure neuronal activity non-invasively. And so there's this whole group that says, oh, it's unknowable, you can't ever know it. But like, I can tell you what images you're thinking of. You can dump your dreams directly to video right now using a $3 million fMRI machine. So there's the people saying it's impossible, and then there's the people that are doing it already. So it's interesting because there's so much effort around the brain. There's so many people doing it. I think we're doing a top-down approach. There's the Allen Institute's definitely a bottom-up. Paul Allen is like that. You know, he's fantastic. I think he's amazing. There's people coming at this from all different angles. You have the national academies of most developed countries saying, of the top 5 things a technologist can do right now, somewhere on that top 5 list is reverse engineering the brain. And so, yes, I mean, the point is, what happens when we achieve that? We think we can do it much, I mean, we should be able to hit millions of people in the first 5 years and hundreds of millions of people within a decade with the technology I'm proposing. And the resolution is going to go up because we can use the manufacturing infrastructure of Asia that's very good at making the feature sizes we need for this.
Where are you now in perfecting this technology and getting it ready for use?
So we've given ourselves the first year to explore the bounding box of the physics. How deep can we go? How fast can we go? What resolution? So what scanning speed? What depth? What resolution? How reliably can we get neurons and other features? Should we just go for blood or oxygen or what? Clogged arteries first, what should be the first product? We're trying to find the limits of the technology right now and the artifacts imposed when you really print the various devices. Because when you shine, there's theory versus practice, and then there's this back and forth we're doing with a series of different architectures, kind of like a contest between them. And then we make a Franken architecture because we try to take the best of each. And so we're doing a lot more experiment, because once you go into the big fabs of Asia, they're not R&D facilities. You better ship really quick. And so the only time we have for experimentation when you do hardware like this, using fabs that don't take any external designs.
You've got this first year, you're giving yourself to draw the boundaries, you said, and then what? What comes after that?
We decide what the product is, and we ship the product, the first product. So we're not sure what the first product should be, and a lot of it will have to do with what depth, resolution, cost structure we decide. We'll probably go with some first early access partners, like so many hospitals and so many entities that want to work with us to
develop the technology.
And that's
the first market, hospitals?
We don't know. Maybe
you don't know.
Maybe it's to go directly to telepathy. We're purposely not deciding. It's weird. I also purposely didn't drive up and down Sand Hill Road. I didn't make a pitch deck. I broke all the rules on this. I just started talking about it, and the billionaires came to me. And I just, rule number one, I try not to get billionaires in technology mad at me. But it's sort of heady stuff. It's my fourth startup. I felt like I could not follow the rules, but no, I don't have the product pitch deck and we're gonna make this amount of money at this time. Like, no, when you're doing something that's 1,000 times lower cost, that has the potential to transform humanity in this way, you really don't worry about the product roadmap. Like, there's a ton of products. We just have to decide which one to go first and why, based on the limits of the physics, what's easy to do, what's hard to do, should we go for a reach goal or not, but we need to understand the bounding box of the physics.
First of all, let's just stay with this startup notion for a minute. You're a few months into this. Many startups are still in what is commonly known as stealth mode. Nobody wants anyone to know about a company, especially one that's as potentially revolutionary as this. And you don't believe in stealth mode. In fact, I even read you said that secrecy is not helpful, just generally when you're doing something like this. Why do you have that approach?
There's so few people that can help us. We want them to come beat our path to our door. When we did the $100 laptop, we started telling people we're going to make a $100 laptop. We heard, that's crazy, that'll never work. Bill Gates, Steve Jobs, Michael Dell, Craig Barrett, the then chairman of Intel, not the Google executive, all just said, it's crazy, it's never going to work. And so then we got the crazy people of the world to beat a path to our door to help us make it happen. So that was pretty interesting. They also helped us debug it. And that was pretty interesting and heady experience. In the case of this one, the main reason to talk about it is to try to define what it means to be responsible, because I can't separate the physics of the medical imaging from the physics of the telepathy. And so it's funny, this literally a rock star, a friend of mine who's now a human rights activist, Peter Gabriel, he called me every week for 6 months trying to convince me to quit Facebook, to take this technology out and do it as a startup so I could be more open about talking about it, because we needed to define the ethical and he felt it was going to happen, we're not going to be able to hold it back, but how do we get in front of it and how do we help all of the technologists working on technologies, biotech, CRISPR, Cas9, all the different things that are happening, optogenetics, figure out how to bring these forth in the world in the most responsible way that we can, because the potential for misuse is strong unless we can engineer a system around the big threats.
Yeah.
And so how do we do that? And I think the pragmatic thing is to teach people how to lie or tell mistruths into the system, but that might not be ethical to lie. And so what did we do? What's the right thing? Well, we should have a dialogue with ethicists all over the world and lots of different groups. The days of a committee of ethicists sitting behind those doors to decide what's ethical or not are over. Our notions of what is appropriate for privacy are changing every year right now, and there's no way to do it. According to the ethicists, who I've spent a lot of time talking to, they mostly ask questions. They're really, Socratic.
The ethicists.
The ethicists are mostly Socratic. They ask questions. And, we're changing a lot right now, and they feel a public dialogue is necessary, not just in Silicon Valley and Boston, but globally. As we unfold this.
I'm interested to hear you talk about all the people who can help and that you need them to come in and help, and the ethicists are one. Where are the neuroscientists in all of this? Are they on your side? Are they not on your side? Are they helping, not helping? What's going on with the experts in the brain?
The experts in the brain are interested in better tools, but a lot of them have never been exposed to this way of thinking and think they should have had it in their PhD program. I'm like, well, you know, at that point in time, diffuse optical tomography was proved to be mathematically impossible, which is why you never had it in your PhD program. But, you know, the notion of, because I'm a neuroscientist, I know all about consumer electronics and optics and everything in the world is also false. But I'm amazed at what the neuroscientists have done, which is why I've joined the field. I'm dazzled by what they've done using functional magnetic resonance imaging. People like Jack Gallen, and there's I won't list all of them, but 20 years ago, some classmates of mine went into brain mapping. And I really thought it was like modern day phrenology, and they were wasting their career, and I was nice. I didn't put it like that. I'm being more provocative now. And looking sort of 20 years later at what they've done, I guess that was now 30 years, I'm dazzled. I'm really dazzled, and I thought it was time to pick up and help them.
You're dazzled at how close they were 30 years ago.
Oh, sorry. When they went into it, I thought, how do you map the brain? It's too complicated. How do you figure out how it works? A bit, and Paul Allen, oh, it's so complicated. Why are they? And then I look at what has been accomplished in some aspects of the field, and I thought, I think they've done amazing jobs. They need people to make, we need to make better tools to be able to see in higher resolution through the system. And I believe it has to be non-invasive, and that's controversial for neuroscientists, but there's two reasons it has to be non-invasive. Elective brain surgery is a non-starter. Do I need to explain more? I mean, I've had brain surgery. It was the hardest thing I did in my life. So, and number two is, as we think about privacy, you know, my cell phone is off. It's actually literally off. I did that to be on stage with you. But apparently people can still listen in. Unless, if I can take the battery out of this one. I've got an old one. I won't do that right now. However, what happens if you've got an implant? Can people listen in? What if you want to really have some private thoughts? Can you just take it off and remove it? I think those two things are fundamental to make a technology that can scale. And I just think, you know, the needle probes, when you put a needle through all of those neurons, you're killing all the neurons as you get to the one you want to read. You also have to open up the skull. It's a lot. So I don't know why people think that's the way to go. I don't know how you get to hundreds of millions of people that way in a voluntary way. I think the idea of putting silicon nanoparticles in the bloodstream, the thing, as far as I know, Elon's doing, it's sketchy, he's a smart guy, clearly very effective, done amazing things. Wow, it's cool he's entering, but the first method he's talked about, when your capillaries are 2 microns in width, even your red blood cells are larger, they're 7 microns. They squish down to go through the 2 microns. And they can't even squish down right when you have some diseases like malaria. They stiffen, and so that's why you get brain damage in malaria. So if you're putting in pieces of silicon in 2 micron, like, aren't you? It's a leading cause of death in the world, clogged arteries that cause strokes, and we're putting solid particles in vain. Like, I think it'll take a while to get FDA approval. But when I think of Elon, I think, why is he doing it? What is he thinking? And this is where I get to. He hasn't said this. He wants to go to Mars. He wants to go light years away. Our bodies aren't strong enough. So do we need to become cyborgs to enable us to go light years away? And is that because your brain won't last light years in space? Is that, I mean, it's a question.
That's a great hypothesis.
I saw him at a party a few weeks ago, but I didn't know he was doing this, so next time I'll ask him.
If you and I were wearing these devices tonight, would we be communicating telepathically?
I think we'll all start to do that. I mean, won't we, like, swim our minds, let our minds out and swim around with each other and the computers? It'll be like, I mean, here's the thing, if we don't turn on the filters, it might be like being at Burning Man all the time, you know? And like, so do we get like the sex and violence filters and turn them on, or like what you had for dinner? Like, well, all the things that you think of, like, how do you focus? And can, you know, And then all of the biases, you know, there's just incredible things. The human frailty, like, can you imagine having to run human resources at any company? if you could really see what people were thinking in a meeting, like, we have all this politeness. And so, like, how do we learn how to transcend that and learn how to deal with the fact that we hear little lies all the time for social lubrication and deal with things really openly and honestly and expose ourselves? We might have to take lessons to become comfortable in revealing ourselves. So it's a big step.
Why do tech companies think they can do med tech better than life sciences professionals? Why don't they hire us experienced life science pros?
We're hiring life science people that have been working in imaging using near-infrared.
Yeah.
So we have those on
and
our
it's,
team.
And it's not necessarily better, is it? I mean, you're trying to knit together a lot of people with a lot of different expertise to solve a problem.
Really multidisciplinary background. We're hiring, I mean, I just, so thrilled. I just got this guy. He's been designing really cool holographic systems for like 30 years. Craig Neuswanger. He's like a legend in holography. And oh my gosh, I mean, one of the things, he's done a lot of art holography. And you could say that's not important until you look at the history, just specifically in holography. The scientists made these awful-looking display holograms. And then you'd look at Craig's holograms. Really low signal-to-noise ratio, because that's what artists actually do, because they care what the image looks like. But in terms of diversity, I mean, we've got lots of different people. We're hiring people from life sciences. But what we're making are display chips and cameras and holograms. So to do that, we need people that have made displays and holograms and worked with near-infrared light. And those are the types of people we're hiring. And then AI people and artists. We're hiring artists because I believe that's important.
There's so many questions here about privacy. And you touched on it a minute ago and the work you're doing with ethicists. But where do you come down on this? Where do you think the boundaries will be drawn or redrawn in the area of privacy if telepathy actually becomes a reality?
I think different people will set their own filters. The concern is any government. People think other countries, but our country could do this too. The police or military making you wear a hat or a little ski hat, I propose. Or maybe worse, your parents making you wear it when you come in at 3 a.m. on a Friday night and want to know where you were. And, you know, should that be allowed? What is that? And so I think where I go to is we have to teach people how to foil the system or enable a true consensual use in the system. Our system, our system will only work consensually. My fear is once the technology is out of the bag, people can copy the physics and make one that can work non-consensually. That's why I'm worried about this, because when you use the fabs of Asia, you're letting it out there. It took 3 years to copy an iPhone. How many years is it going to take to copy this technology? 5 years, if you put enough people on it. And so that's great, because we will get cost down, yield up. The four words that describe a lot of the Asian manufacturing infrastructure. So this can be very low cost. But if we're not controlling that consensual aspect of it, how do we make it so that people can be that switch so it can only work if they wish it to work? And so that's the thing that keeps me up at night, the responsible way to do that. That's where I go to. Hmm. But we're engaging in a dialogue with lots of different organizations on this. Not an internal organization behind closed doors, but many openly out there from lots of different countries, lots of different cultures and backgrounds to see where they go. But that's my fear, is even though we can commit for consensual, what do we do about people that copy the technology? And so it's...
What do you do to protect your own intellectual property?
File patents, and then we talk about it because we think it's important to make it happen, and we think it's important to make it happen responsibly. And so it's sort of, Peter Gabriel calls it this Oppenheimer cocktail, that the technologists sort of pioneering this of, exuberance and, you know, this fear of misuse, and how do we address it? I read a lot of Oppenheimer, like, great, like, Oppenheimer was one of the creators of nuclear technology, and it, you know, was really tortured about the effect of the nuclear bombs on killing so many people. And so what do we do as we march forward to try to be more responsible in creating the technology? We talk about it, for one, and so we file the patents, and once we file, we actually start talking about it. But the patent office...
Has that happened already, that people have seen your patents and they're starting to say, well, this is...
Our patents
have... certainly have to talk about this.
Our patents have been approved to issue, but actually the moment we filed them, we started talking about
yes.
them, even before they were approved. And they may not have been approved, but they were, so...
Do you do that informally? Do you have a forum? Do you convene people where you get together? I mean, you're out there. You're here tonight, so that obviously is starting a dialogue already.
Yeah, we're thrilled to talk, especially at the Computer History Museum. We think people have faced this problem before.
Yeah.
And what can we learn from the good ways that people have dealt with it? And what are ideas for marching through this? Mm. So there's the people who believe, oh, it'll never happen. If we fail, like, fine, who cares? But even if you don't believe anything I'm saying, if you think you have to, you know, like, it's going to happen. And what do we do about it when it happens? And how do we deal with the consensual and non-consensual nature of this? I mean, Jerry Yang was tortured when he released the emails 20 years ago for a Yahoo customer to the Chinese government. And then it turned out they were Chinese dissidents and they were jailed in an awful jail. He felt very tortured. None of us knew that was going to happen. That was the first sort of thing on my radar where that happened. And so then they made protective provisions around that to make sure government couldn't get email of, you know. But how do we avoid those things? Certainly there's been a lot in the march for online for digital and privacy and our discussion of privacy. But this ups that by an order of magnitude or more. Like, it's a whole different level of privacy.
Well, and I want to go back to something you said just a second ago, which is, this is going to happen. For a lot of us in this audience tonight, this is the very first we've heard about an $800 MRI device that's going to allow you to communicate telepathically. And the woman who's inventing it is now saying, this is definitely going to happen.
It's inevitable. The physics is solid. The engineering is solid. There's nothing stark raving mad about this at all.
So we need to get ready for this.
The Facebook system looks... I can tell you the physics of that is solid. Elon, I don't know, it's Elon. It does amazing. Are you going to bet against Elon Musk? I mean, come on. And then, you know, there's other companies, too, that are entering the fray. And so we stand on the shoulders of, by the way, this has been going on in the universities for decades. There's astonishing neuroscientists and physicists and people that have brought us to this point. And in each approach, you can... The physics seems incredibly solid. This is the thing that we enable is low cost. We haven't guaranteed $800. We don't know the cost of the first structure. We have to cover the development cost. But at scale, there is no reason it has to cost more than a smartphone, because we're using the subcomponents, actually less subcomponents than are in your smartphone at volume.
I should say
but
that
it won't
was
guarantee
that
the
was
first
my
price.
Number because it's the yeah, cost of a smartphone today.
Today, so and yeah. that will continue. So it should be right lower by the time we hit volume. It's all based on volume in the manufacturer. So we're the ones that are bringing the consumer electronics supply chain in this, so that it can scale to millions of people very quickly.
There are a couple of questions here about medical conditions that could be detected.
Right.
By this kind of science. And one of them, which came in over Facebook Live, is blood glucose levels being measured non-invasively. Is that possible?
There's been a lot of work on that. When I was at Google, I got to hang out with the now called Verily, Google Life Sciences people. And there was a lot of work on that. We haven't looked into glucose much yet at open water. Blood is such a large signal in the red, in the infrared, because blood is red and it's even infrared, so it's like really easy to measure. It's a huge signal. We're excited about neurons. People have asked us about myelin sheaths, and that looks easy because of the polarization properties. We're looking at other things. We haven't tried glucose. Mm. But certainly there's been a lot of effort on non-invasive glucose in research groups I'm aware of.
And what about...
I can't say much more, but we could look at it.
What about conditions like depression? Is that detectable?
Yeah. In fact, I had the head of a very large European country's mental health institutes, plural, say the moment we have this ski hat, he's issuing it to every patient with clinical depression in the entire country. And that's because I learned from him, clinical depression, a lot of people kill themselves. 1 million people kill themselves every year globally. A lot of them with mental disease, 90% of them with mental disease, a lot of those with clinical depression. People don't kill themselves at rock bottom in clinical depression. They kill themselves as they're coming out of it, often in a nonlinear, erratic way due to the therapy. If the doctor can measure neurologically what's happening, we can keep the clinically depressed patient safe so they recover. And so that's what the Mental Health Institute people tell me. And there's a host of other diseases that enable communication and therapy. We can keep neurons alive longer by applying infrared light. That's FDA approved. Now we can focus it. So people with Alzheimer's, we can clear amyloid plaques with infrared light. We're using infrared light focused. Amyloid plaques are related to Alzheimer's. And so there's an enormous amount of work being done in brain science and neuroscience and all the, you know, brain disease and all the subclasses of it. And they are lacking tools, a tool that we can deliver to them that can do things that haven't been possible before. This is always possible.
Well, that could be a great outcome of this.
Yeah, and it's the number one, as I mentioned before, the number one health expenditure in the world is brain disease. Because it takes so long to cure and it's so expensive, people live with it for a long time. They tend to not, it takes a long time to die of neurological disease, and mental disease incapacitates so many people. Every family has it. Every family has it. And we are stuck in not being able to do much to help those people. And so just even a wearable system with a resolution of an MRI, like if you're clinically depressed, sure, we could throw you in an MRI machine for 3 months and monitor your clinical depression, but it's unlikely you're gonna come out of it laying in the MRI machine for 3 months, right? Because it's somewhat depressing, right? It's just, so if you can walk around with it, it would be way better.
Are there any physical consequences? This isn't one of the audience questions. Physical consequences or side effects of using this device?
We're talking about benign near-infrared light at light levels lower than walking outside here in Mountain View on an afternoon like today when the sun was out. So much lower levels, more like a cloudy day. And so there are none known. It's far below the light levels allowed. It's close to visible light. It's benign. But, you know, we're going to check that everything's safe. It's all approved at these levels already by the many people that have already created near-infrared systems. When you go in the hospital and you put one of those clips on your finger that measures your blood oxygen level, you look at it, like, that's infrared light looking at the color change of your blood, whether it has oxygen on it or not. Those are widely used, for example.
Right. Here's a personal question that goes back to something you said earlier, which is you said you're usually underestimated as a woman. Has that affected your life and work for good or not so good?
Well, you just try to leverage whatever you can. When you realize people don't think you can do it, like this idea that girls can't do whatever, like, they're getting all the A's. Like, I was doing calculus in junior high school. Like, I was the smartest kid in the room. Like, I really was. I hope no one from my high school is watching. No, they're smart too, sorry. On one measure of measuring it. I think there's many levers. So underestimated, I mean, you go in, you look different. Yeah, they don't think you can do it. And so you just, you do it anyway. You just find a way. The stuff I liked was also super hard to find, so that took a lot. So I think that's just the nature of being other, and so you need to find a way through it. But by being other, you can see things they can't see, whether it's other because I like optics or holography, and in a sort of valley where CS is a computer science is a synonym for STEM, and anybody from science, technology, physics, engineering, and so forth, or math isn't really, you know, it's sort of pretty easy to be other, which means you're going to be able to figure out different things. No one's going to listen to you or pay attention, but, you know, when you're working in a company like Google or Facebook, you can still get millions of dollars to prototype it, so it's okay. It's pretty cool, actually.
You mentioned earlier this STEAM notion and the need to think, or how much fun you found it to be to stand at this intersection of technology and art. Are we hanging on to that concept today in education? Are we in danger of losing that concept? Where do you think we are from a policy and just a practical standpoint about the way people are being trained to think these days?
Yeah. It's this notion of training, right? Like, how do you let kids explore and do the things that grab them because they can learn about it? It seems more expensive, and yet is it more expensive or not? I mean, otherwise, like, we have kids dropping out of math and science and engineering at pretty early stages, and yet it's pretty fun, and they would love it. And, you know, I was at this art school. It was interesting to go from... I go back and forth, and in art there's a lot of women, and in science there's a lot of guys, and in fact, like, it's not that different from where I sit. So how are we educating? I just was at a meeting where the new Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, was, and I don't really understand her policies, but I'm hoping that how do we leverage the kids themselves? That's what we kept thinking at One Laptop Per Child. Can we make the kids the Trojan horse of whatever educational system we throw them in so they can become creative to dig their way out of it? But like sounds pretty strong and negative, but it's just, what are we, I don't think we're doing a great job, and yet the flip side of it is we do get all the smart people from the world. We do have places like Silicon Valley, the Computer History Museum. Something's working, right? So, great. But like a certain percent of people it's working for, but the vast majority of people it's not. And so then we have people making decisions that can't even understand the most basic concepts of science and statistics and so forth, which is quite... problematic.
Sobering.
Limiting.
And limiting.
Given the scientific method seems, you know, to be pretty well established now. So, yeah, I mean, these are the problems. And so how do you get around them? How do we work on the U.S. is really hard. I worked in education with One Laptop Per Child. We have more school districts in the United States than the entire rest of the world combined. It's usually centrally done but in the Ministry of Education, with a few people from the ministry, some of the great intellectuals of the country, and some of the top school teachers, and they figure out what the curriculum is. But I'd love to quote Alan Kay. I mean, I remember being with him. He helped us start One Laptop Per Child, and we were in Tunisia at a UN summit on the digital divide. And we went to see this ruins he knows about because Alan's sort of an expert on everything. Computer History Museum fellow, inventor of the Dynabook, many, many things, and Scratch, and a lot of different, maybe didn't do Scratch, Squeak. And he was looking, and he pointed down on the road to this kind of rut in the road, and he said, I'll buy dinner for anybody who can tell me what this is called. And we were absolutely exhausted from running this thing in Tunisia where Kofi Annan unveiled my hand-soldered prototype, and I hadn't slept more than 2 hours, and it felt like a month. I'm like, oh, Alan, I have no idea. Nobody took his bait. And he finally just said, it's a curriculum. It's the rut in the Roman road. That's the curriculum. We want people to follow this rut in a road. That's what everybody follows. I mean, we're not going to get creativity if we get everybody doing the same thing, right? Mm-hmm. And so how do we encourage people to go different ways. I didn't know a curriculum was a rut in a road, so did you?
And then finally, Open Water is your company, and if Open Water succeeds and this technology, these devices succeed, optimistically, if you look 5-7 years down the road, what do you hope will happen if you bring this to market and it works the way that you think it should?
We can massively reduce the cost of healthcare. That's what needs to happen. I mean, we're hearing, it's just too expensive. We can't keep going in this direction, certainly in this country or in any country. So we have to work on that. The other thing I hope is we can amplify ourselves, understand ourselves. If we're scared of our thoughts, of whatever we're thinking about each other, I mean, it's still, it's fundamental to who we are. We have to sort of get over it and walk through it to sort of deal with ourselves or make ourselves into what we hope to be. I hear that from people, you don't want to know what's going on in my head, or my wife, she can't know, and I'm like, what, you think about sex? It's okay, it's part of everything. And so there's a fear of it, and yet if we don't understand ourselves, we're limiting what we can do. And it's not, by the way, we're not, this might sound nutty, but I just want to make an observation. We're not the only thing on the planet with brains. There's all of these other animals that we might be able to communicate with and collaborate with. It'd be really interesting to be able to communicate with an octopus, for example. Sounds nutty, but it's not that nutty. Does your dog really love you, or does it want to have food? These are important questions.
I can't wait to go home and ask my dog. That's a great thought. Mary Lou Jepson, thank you for being here tonight. We're going to be looking on with interest. Thank you.
That was Mary Lou Jepson, CEO and founder of Open Water. Next time, hear from the CEO and co-founder of GitHub on how he built the social coding tool. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of CHM Live Radio. This podcast is produced by Chanel Loren and me, Lauren Miyamoto. John Plute composed our intro music, and transitional music is provided by Lee Rosevere. You can learn more about our events and the museum at computerhistory.org.
This program was brought to you by the Computer History Museum.